This week on Retronauts, all-you-can-eat barbecue at the gas pump near the graveyard. Hello, welcome to Retronauts. Ooh, it's spooky this week because we are talking about Night of the Living Dead, the movie that's celebrating its 55th anniversary, and it's, let's be honest, it's a big anniversary because this movie has a long shadow that it cast over movies, video games, the culture, everything. It's a big movie. Who am I? I'm not a big movie. I'm a relatively small person. My name's Diamond Fight. I am a legally licensed funeral wreath reseller. So, you know, it's a good gig if you can get it.
Man, for someone who claims not to be a super movie nerd, you're really kicking in with the deep cuts here on this movie. Yeah, okay.
Who is that? Who just spoke in there? Who spoke out of turn? Who is that?
I'm Bill Mudrin. I actually have no real idea why I'm on this podcast other than just being a movie nerd who's from Pittsburgh. And so thank you for having me on the show.
That's enough. We need the Pittsburgh power for this podcast, Bill. We need it. And our other returning guest, not from the grave, from another episode.
Yes, I'm coming to get you, Diamond. It's me, James Eldred.
Oh, no. You can't get me. You're in the same country as me, but you're hundreds of miles away. My doors are locked.
Yeah, I can find you. You'll see me coming, though, because let's be real. Like, I'm 2 meters tall.
I know.
I feel bad for not having a bit. I should have made it seem like you guys were the only podcasters on the podcast, and then I would have stormed up with my wife and my sick child and be like, what are you guys doing here? And it would have been a very terse podcast. You know?
My B bit was going to be, I'm not dead, but I'm all messed up. It was one of the I was kind of going back and forth because like my hips
on fire, they're all messed up.
My hip is a disaster. But anyway. Yeah.
God.
So we're talking about a classic horror film this week, which means we need to share our stories of when did you first actually see this movie? I will go first because I'm the host, and I can tell you that I first saw a version of it, a truncated version, on television, and this was a pre-Mystery Science Theater 3000, like, joke show, like the kind of show that would just air old movies that they had the rights to and just, like, you know, basically not so much react to them, but, like, basically redub them with dumbass jokes or whatever.
Was this like in the 80s before Mystery Science Theater, so it didn't even have that template follow?
I think so. I believe this was late 80s, and I don't think it lasted very long. But so I remember watching this movie, you know, with some people joking about it. They, you know, the only joke I remember is that when Ben goes upstairs and finds the decomposing body, you know, the voice is like, oh, the lettuce has gone bad. And, like, that's the only joke I remember. So
that's kind of what it looks like. That's not, like, yeah.
Yeah. So it wasn't until many years later, probably, like, late 90s, that I actually rented the original and watched it. And I was just like, whoa, this is awesome. And then I went on to watch the other movies, which I think are better in some ways, less rough around the edges, which is kind of a downer. But otherwise, well, big fan of these movies.
The version that you saw, was it edited for time or was it edited for content? Because there's not that much in here aside from like a naked lady butt and the mom getting stabbed to death. And even then, that's still kind of, you could kind of show that on basic cable.
I'm pretty sure the TV version I saw, I think was very, very truncated. I think it was a half hour show of just like public domain footage, hence this movie, you know, like. There was another one where it was just like, you know, it was like a bunch of like romantic comedy. So I think there's like whatever they could get, they would put on the air. And, you know, they had these probably, you know, actors working for scale, just dubbing over old movies, you know.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I don't think I would have looked up the show, but I think the show has just lost the history. And
it sounds like you're watching like Channel 64 UHF or something like that. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm going to shut up and let you guys talk. Okay.
It's all right. But it's okay. It's time for you to share your stories. Bill, why don't you share your story? When did you see this movie?
I don't have a particular story. I just, you know, from growing up in Pittsburgh, I don't know what James's age is. I was born in 1975.
I'm 79.
Oh, okay. So we're within the ballpark of each other.
Yeah.
It was kind of like when I was a little kid, it was a little bit before videotape was really common, you know, renting and stuff like that. So I probably just caught it on, like, local airings and stuff. But it just seemed like an old crappy black and white movie, so I didn't care about it too much. Because, you know, I grew up reading Fangoria and Starlog magazine, and they would talk about Night of the Living Dead and about how amazing it was. And, you know, I'd recognize it when I was flipping through the channels on TV and just kind of go, it's just a black and white movie where the soundtrack's just going, pew, boo. And, like, it didn't seem Compared to all the other slasher horror movies that were out there, like, it just didn't seem like that much. And of course, I think probably in high school, I finally, rented a copy of it and actually managed to sit down and watch the whole thing. I thought it was pretty good, but it's still kind of crappy and boring in comparison to everything. I was a little bit older, so I could at least appreciate, understanding how much it influenced everything that had come after, then I can kind of appreciate what that movie did. But yeah, as a kid, though, yeah, it just kind of rolled off me, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, my history is much different than I think both of you. My history of this film is neonatal because literally because
you can
my
see
dad
there, like at the drive-in.
No. My dad once I was told when my mom was 6 months pregnant with me, my dad rented a projector and this film.
Oh wow!
To show his mother-in-law, which went over really well.
Yeah, that's a Homer Simpson move right there.
And
yeah.
Then when my dad had the video store that I grew up in the 80s,
store. Holy shit, that would be a different upbringing.
Yeah, my family owned a video store, Sights and Sounds Home Video in Toledo, Ohio, and he would put this on the TVs there when I was there, because my dad, as I've said many times on my podcast, was not a good censor. And it really messed me up to the point where, like, if it was on TV, I would avoid flicking through the channels. I would skip that channel.
Manually. Okay, yeah.
And we had the Good Times video VHS box with the
pink.
The zombies,
I remember the Good Times label stuff. Yeah,
the zombies in the pajamas and the underwear on the cover, and like it would freak. And it was like eye level to me at the store, and that and the cover to Day of the Dead would really freak me out.
Ooh.
And like it got to the point where like Liquid Television did a stick figure theater of this movie, and that scared me.
Oh no!
I totally forgot about that. I
had to go to therapy because of Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. And therapy and Prozac are wonderful things. And eventually, I was able to sit down and watch this and Day of the Dead and Dawn of the Dead and every other zombie film that's of note, and watch them. And I got over it. Although funnily enough, well, maybe not funnily enough, interestingly enough, I was held up at gunpoint while watching Day of the Dead. So, in my house. That's a whole other story, though. So, yeah.
By a zombie?
No, I don't know. I didn't get a good look at his face.
Was it Bub from Day of the Dead? Did he finally get the gun?
No, Bud's nicer than these motherfuckers. Anyway.
I don't know.
But, yeah. And then later on, I moved to Pittsburgh, and I lived in Squirrel Hill, which is about, like, a 10-minute drive away from the mall in Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah.
Ooh.
And, living in Pittsburgh, you are... It's a zombie town, and like you, I met enough boomers who knew somebody who was in the movie at some point, and like you go to comic book conventions, and I have seen like half the cast of this movie in person.
So when were you living in Pittsburgh too? Like what span?
I moved to Pittsburgh in probably 2004.
Oh, so I moved out of Pittsburgh in 2004 because I lived in Squirrel Hill, and I was about to ask you if ran into each other at shows or something. Okay.
I lived right behind Jerry's Records. But yeah, and living in Pittsburgh kind of helped me get over the zombie phobia. But still, I don't like to really return to this movie too much because it's not a happy film. And
no, it's dour.
It kind of puts me in a bad headspace still. So... this is the first time I've watched it probably, I think since moving to Japan, I've watched it twice, including this week. So, okay. And it's probably the last time. Sorry, that's my story. Sorry, mine is so long, but that's my story about this movie.
That's cool. That's great.
I'm very glad, James, that you came to terms with the movie and you were able to appreciate it on some level. I'm sorry that it brings you stress, and I appreciate that you're willing to stress yourself even partially to join us on the show this week. But
it's okay. I'll get by. I'll watch some Muppets tonight. I'll be okay.
I don't know, that Muppets Tonight puppet with the wiry hair and the weird eyes is almost scarier than some of the stuff in this movie, but shut up, Bill. Okay.
Not Meet the Feebles, but anyway, go ahead.
Meet the Feebles. Yeah, okay, that's a whole, yeah, okay.
You know, it's funny, social media loves to do that gag of, oh, remake a movie with Muppets except for one human character, and I feel like this movie would be a perfect choice.
I mean, it's gotta be, you gotta keep Ben as the human, right? And then everyone else, because I mean...
I would say Ben or Barbara, really.
Barbara becomes such a non... It's actually kind of funny, though. I like the idea of her being slapped by a puppet. Not because I like the idea of women being hit, but, like, just because she doesn't... She kind of stops being a character after the
first
third of
the... Totally, we do it and make Barbara Miss Piggy. And Miss Piggy would murder the F out of all these
zombies.
That's
the funny thing. She would just karate... Like, there would be no ending of the movie because she would just karate... There would be no real problem because she would just karate chop everyone.
Then it would solve all the feminist issues with the film.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Actually, Kermit the Frog is Ben, though. Like, their whole relationship, like... Oh,
I don't want to think about that. Anyway, go ahead. Keep on going, Diamond.
So, before we get to the film proper, I want to talk about a few of the names behind the film, especially the big name behind the film, Mr. George A. Romero. Officially, the A is Andrew, but Quentin Tarantino once said it stood for a fucking genius. Mm-hmm. So... Romero was the director. He co-wrote the script. He is a cinematographer. He edited this movie. He probably made some sandwiches for someone at some point. This is very much his baby. It was his first ever feature film, and that's what an amazing origin story. I'm sorry. I know a lot of people get their break in horror, and, you know, Sam Raimi got some horror movies, and you know, I know everyone's tried to make horror movies and stuff, but the fact to make this your first ever movie and just, wow, what an impact. What a debut. And many years later, he was quoted as saying, I tried early on to do several films that were non-genre, you know, not horror movies. And nine people saw them. So I don't have a credential. I don't have credentials in that regard.
Have you guys seen much of his other stuff then?
I've seen a few pictures. I know Martin, the one where the kid thinks he's a vampire. I thought that was great. I love that one.
That's an interesting idea because, he thinks he's a vampire. Well, the movie never quite definitely says whether or not he's a – it definitely leans towards he thinks that he's a vampire.
That's a strange movie.
He believes he's a vampire, so he acts like a vampire. Is he really a vampire? I don't know. But if he acts like it and he does all the things vampires do
– I mean, he's still hurting people and stuff.
Yeah. So
yeah. Morally, he's still –
I've seen all the dead films except Survival, and I've seen Martin and Creepshow many times.
Creepshow, right.
Creepshow's great. I still haven't seen... I really want to see Monkey Signs and Knight Riders, but I just haven't gotten around to it.
Knight Riders is hilarious.
And The Crazies. The Crazies is a great movie.
I need to see Crazies. I've never... Yeah.
Didn't someone recently find a new copy of Knight Riders? Like, they found a restored copy somewhere?
Yeah. Somebody's, like... It's probably, like, Arrow or something like that. Vinegome Syndrome or something like that. Knight Riders is great because it's about traveling gangs of...
Motorcycle jousting.
Yeah, what's the thing you do at Ren Fairs with the horses and the big sticks
jousting.
That they do?
They do
that, and it's just Tom Savini's the villain, and it's the first movie starring what's his name from The Abyss.
Ed Harris. Really?
Yeah.
It's one of his early.
It's
films.
Like a 25 year old Ed Harris, and he's hot and awesome and badass.
Does he have hair?
No,
not really. You kind of look at him and says, "Jesus, this guy ever have hair?" Yeah, no, it's totally like that kind of thing. But no, it's and Knight Riders is more sense of humor. It's not trying to be like a real like you know. It's.
One interesting thing about Romero that I always found worth mentioning is that like his influences are definitely not horror.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Well, that's he kind of got pigeonholed.
He was way into it. Like the film that he says makes him want to make movies is Tales of the Hoffman. Which is an opera.
There's a anecdote about how supposedly, like, whatever video store that he and Scorsese frequented together in New York, they were the only two people who ever rented that movie out, The Tales of Hoffman.
I've seen it. It's a beautiful, beautiful movie. And I could see why, if you are interested in making films, that's a movie you want to watch. Because it's a very, the way it uses the film specifically to tell an opera. It's a fascinating film. I recommend The Tales of Hoffman. Yeah, first person to say that on Retronauts.
And I know when Romero died, he died listening to the soundtrack from The Quiet Man, the John Wayne movie where he pretends to be Irish for 2 hours. And just something about that always kind of struck me as interesting that, like, he wasn't really a horror guy. And you just kind of became that because that's what it paid, what paid the bills. And yeah, after Night of the Living Dead hit big, he tried to make, I mean, the next movie he made was the late, was with the lady who plays Judy in this movie. A terrible, I've tried to watch it. It's a movie called There's Always Vanilla. And the movie is as bad as that title. And he tried it, like, he was like, okay, now this Night of the Living Dead, you know, hit big, I can try my hand at other stuff. I'm not just a horror guy. But nothing clicked, and he just kind of came back to horror as just, that's what paid the bills 10 years later with Dawn of the Dead. But
yeah, I don't think, you know, I guess, like, a lot of people don't set out to become horror guys, but, you know, if the shoe fits, yeah, you know, if you make
a lot of horror, you can make a good horror movie for cheap more than you can make almost any other kind of genre of movie if you know what you're doing. Or if you just happen to hit her on even if you don't know what you're doing, which is kind of the story of this movie, is well, you kind of accidentally back into something that maybe you don't even understand how, what a live wire of a subject matter it is with people between, like, the racial issues in this movie and just, like, no one had really done kind of like a violent zombie movie like this before. And, or I guess maybe a couple people have, but no one was lucky enough like George Romero was with this movie.
And it was everyone's first movie, but he was a very good, if you go to YouTube and type in, like, George Romero commercials, you'll find some of his old commercials, and they're very well done.
Yeah, he had a lot of clever stuff, yeah.
Very kinetic and fantastic editing, which also transfers to this film. You know, the direction in this is relatively rudimentary because of technical limitations, but the editing is just top notch, fantastic. Yeah,
one of his commercials that he'd done, he did, like, it was like for like a dish,
Calgon.
Calgon. It was like, yeah, for clothing detergent, and he did a whole, well, what's the movie? Is it Fantastic Voyage, where everyone shrinks down in the submarine, goes into someone's body?
It is.
Yeah, it's a parody of that, done for a soap commercial for like a budget of $15, and it's cute and it's funny, and so
looks
he knew
great.
What he was doing. But yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, we should also mention, you know, for trivia purists, that, you know, yes, as a man working around Pittsburgh, one of his first jobs was indeed shooting a segment for Mr. Rogers. It's the one where Mr. Rogers goes to the hospital and gets a tonsillectomy. And that's on YouTube, so you can go ahead and watch, you know, a very young Mr. Rogers go to the hospital and with his wife, and Romero is behind the camera and taking care of it.
I love between this and, like, Michael Keaton coming through there, and, oh, God, who fixes the Donkey Kong machine?
Keith David.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Between that, like, there's all kinds of weird people go through Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers is kind of like the Roger Corman of Pittsburgh by accident a little bit, just by virtue of, like...
Mm-hmm.
He's such a long-lived production in Pittsburgh that, like, and if you were making stuff in Pittsburgh, you were probably eventually tangentially related to the Mr. Rogers production. And you can look up some of those. Not a lot of those segments are on YouTube, but a couple of them are, and they're worth checking out, definitely.
So, who wrote the movie with George Romero? It's a man named John Russo, sometimes credited as Jack Russo. I've seen both, so you can pick one. He is still with us. This was his first screenplay. You can see him in the movie. He's one of the zombies. He gets stabbed in the head. So, you know, I guess if you write the movie, you get to play a zombie. Why not? After this movie, he moved on. He did. He started writing some novels, and he adapted his own novels into films. And I have a note here saying the movies are not so great, and James,
okay.
They're quote-unquote, as according to this note, they are nigh unwatchable, which is great.
So people, when people think of him, they think of Return of the Living Dead.
Yes.
And that's only because he barely
wrote that. Like, that's based on his book, heavily rewrote it. Dan O'Bannon
much
took that over.
The title is all they really
now,
took in the end.
Other John Russo films include Midnight, which is one of the stupidest slashers I've ever seen in my entire life. I've never seen some of the other films he directed. He directed something called Santa Claus, which is C-L-A-W-S.
Yeah.
And Nightmare Before Christmas, Santa Claus, yeah.
And The Booby Hatch, which is a softcore porno.
So Jack Russo, he's like the opposite of Romero then, as someone who backed into a good idea but didn't know what to do with his horror talents, yeah.
A couple nights ago, I tried to watch one called The Majorettes, which was produced and written by him and directed by William Heinzman, who was the first zombie in Night of the Living Dead.
Oh.
I turned it off. Now, it was fun to watch. It was made in Coriopolis.
Coriopolis, yeah.
Coriopolis, right outside Pittsburgh, which I have driven through a few times, mostly by accident. And
that's half of anything outside of Pittsburgh, Zeelandopol, or yeah.
And it has a little bit of charm, but it's so ineptly made, so low budget. Nobody can act. The directing is terrible. The script is whatever. The music was horrible. The audio mix made it hard to listen to. I turned it off. John Russo strikes me as somebody who really got lucky the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And
what the story is that, like, he came up with what? So were they originally, like, I guess the idea that they originally came up together was they were going to do like a science fiction, like Teenagers from Outer Space kind of thing. Was a comedy thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And that, for some reason, I think they may have realized that was just going to be too expensive. And they were like, mm-hmm. What can we film that requires no sets, no makeup? Just people walking around, and they kind of like, so I guess Jack Russo came up with the idea we can do like something zombie related, and he wrote like something down. Yeah. And I guess John Romero kind of riffed on that a little bit. And then, yeah. But it sounds like George Romero did all the heavy lifting in terms of like, he turned it into the movie.
I don't know what happened there, but it's the only film they worked on together.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and then they split after this, they decided to take the rights because they were both, you know, responsible for the screenplay. So technically, I guess they decided, well, Jack Russo, so you can take the rights to the whatever sequels involve the word The Living Dead. Hence, yeah. He ends up being responsible for Return of the Living Dead, just tangentially. And George Romero, he gets the ability to name any zombie movie after a time of day.
Well, and also he gets and it was like his movies are sequels to the first one.
That's the more important thing. Even though there's no direct continuity, I've never seen anything beyond Land of the Dead, but at least in the first three classic Romero zombie movies, I mean, they can kind of fit together, even though each one takes place a decade separated from each other. But yeah, you can kind of see it, like, you know, evolution of some kind of meta story there, even though you know, none of the characters show up from one story to the other or anything like that. But yeah, John Russo's whole stuff, and when the Return of the Living Dead story becomes its own little pocket universe and stuff.
Yeah, but, yeah, strange stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I for one am shocked that the director of Scream Queens Naked Christmas is not viewed as an auteur.
It's that kind of guy. Yeah, whereas, you know, while you know, George Romero's off trying to make, you know, There's Always Vanilla, and like he's trying to do like this artistic stuff, and Jack Russo just kind of jerks off and just, yeah, whatever. We're gonna get sued by Jack Russo. I didn't realize he was still alive. Sorry.
This is all parody. This is all parody, by the way. Satire. Parody.
You can just sue me. I'm fine. Go for it.
Cool. I'm making finger quotes. You guys can't see it, but I'm making finger quotes the whole time I was talking about Jack Russell. Right,
I'm giving middle fingers.
Yeah. The best. The most legally defining defense in podcast history.
So not many of the cast would go on to many other things, but I do want to highlight two actors in particular. First of all, the lead role, played by a man named Dwayne Jones, who unfortunately passed away rather young. Yeah. And it's a very significant story because this is a very rare case of a black actor getting a leading role, and it's not really a movie about a black character. There's, you know, the character was not written this way. They had auditions, and they say that Dwayne did the best audition, so they hired him. But it did work out in a funny way that just, you know, his performance and just the era, you know, being 1968, again, this is 1968, kind of a big year. It just so happened to add a little extra flavor to the movie that wasn't there on the page. But after this movie, he didn't do that much, you know, didn't work that much more. I think he seemed like more of like a stage guy. Like, he didn't really want to do a lot of movies, I think. It's like
he mostly worked in universities, and he did help out Romero a couple times, I guess, when they were looking for black actors. He was involved with a theater troupe in New York.
Oh. I wonder if that's a tie-in to, because I know he hired most of the people for Dawn of the Dead out of New York. I wonder if he may have helped out with that.
Yeah, I don't know. But he did. There's an interview with him on the Criterion disc, and he said he had never watched any of the Romero film or any of the Dead movie. And it wasn't he didn't have any ill will towards Romero. Like everybody, he seemed to perfectly enjoy making the film. He just didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
He just didn't really, he wasn't interested in being, you know, paid into horror.
He seems like an interesting dude.
Yeah, he made a few other horror films. There's one I really want to see called Ganja and Hess, which has him and Marlene Clark. And that's I think it's a vampire movie. And Marlene Clark is in one of my favorite bad movies, Beware the Blob. She's also in Switchblade Sisters, which I've covered on my podcast. But it's a vampire film. It's supposed to be quite good. I haven't gotten a chance to watch that yet. But yeah, he seemed like a really interesting, really eloquent guy. Like they'd like I think they'd change the script to make the character more eloquent to match him.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, according to Romero, I guess he was supposed to be just a generic truck driver. And I guess when Jones was like, I don't want to be a black guy who's like a simpleton. Can I just like be like myself practically? Mm-hmm. And they wound up ad-libbing half the dialogue in the movie anyway. So it's kind of Dwayne Jones just being Dwayne Jones in the movie, which means he's the baddest. Well, I guess I can't swear. He's the baddest MF-er in this movie. And not in like, oh, he's the black guy. But just he's just really competent. He's the only person with a real level head in this movie. Kind of at the expense of Barbara just turning into a tomato. Like, as soon as she get, like, after the first 20 minutes of the movie, she's this catatonic weirdo just on the couch. Just, Johnny's got the keys! Johnny's got the keys!
Barbara is a wreck of anxiety with an asshole older brother named John. Both things relatable to me. I am nonstop anxiety, and my brother is named John. So, I'm relatable content, Barbara. I'm with you, honey. I stand for Barbara.
Oh, I'm not saying she's terrible. I mean, also, you also, know, it's she's not the actress's fault or anything but, oh, well, God.
We're talking about Barbara, so let's shout out Judith O'Day, who plays Barbara in the film. She's only 22 when they shot this.
Oh,
she was
man,
very
I feel
young.
Bad for shit-talking her a little bit, because, you know, anyway, yeah.
But very strange career. She only really took one more role after this movie, then she took a long break, but then she came back to acting in the 21st century, So she has way more credits this century than last century, which is just an odd arc.
I wonder if she, like, retired from whatever her day job was after this, and then she was like, oh, I can pick up some extra cash by being in this direct-to-DVD thing where somebody wants Stolen Valor, by like, they'll pay me $200 just to be in this movie, just so they can say, oh, the lady, we're coming to get you, Barbara, is in our movie. I wonder if it's that kind of thing.
I can only hope that she's making, you know, some decent coin on the convention circuit, you know? I mean, if you're in a movie like this, you've got this central role, you know, you're on screen a lot, I feel like you should be able to take advantage of that well into your old age. Just you know, show up and, you know, say your lines and make a face and, you know, get paid, by all means.
My favorite one of those was like the long break is the actress who plays Helen Cooper, Marilyn Eastman. See, this is her only film. Then in 1995, she's in the Sinbad film House Guest.
What? Do you know what she plays or anything like that?
This is an extra. She doesn't have it.
That's a great gap in the IMDb listing for her then, though.
30,
yeah, that's
almost 30 years and then House Guest. Yeah. So
she was just really passionate about the material.
Yeah,
that's what
people
drew her out of retirement.
Yeah, most of the people who worked on this weren't actors. Like,
And that's why you don't see or hear much about these people after this.
Yeah. Like the actor who played the guy who played Harry, he was one of the producers.
Yeah, and he was also Well, and I guess he and the lady you just talked about, they were two people who ran an industrial film company in Pittsburgh, and they're the ones who put up the brunt of the cash for this project. Mm-hmm. And I guess George Romero was like, "We need two people to play the couple in this. You guys want to do it?" And they were like, "Okay, I guess we'll do it."
Yeah, totally. Really quick, I'm curious. How many people in this film have you met? Bill, have you seen in person?
None. I'm trying to think. Why? How that makes it sounds like you're taking me up for a story from you. Like, well, how?
Well, no, I'm just kidding. Well, because if you,
I've got a great Tom Savini story if we ever do a Dawn of the Dead podcast. Okay. But yeah, none of the people in this movie.
You live in Pittsburgh. You go to conventions. You see these people, and like I've seen before he passed, I saw the actor who played Cooper. And I've seen William Heinzman before, the first zombie. And
that zombie is great because he just looks so sad and confused all the time.
Yes, he does. Yeah. He does in real life too. And
he just does look like a guy. He's not really looks like a zombie, but yeah.
And I met the little girl. The little girl sells garden hose with her face on them.
My closest connection to this movie is my friend in high school. In middle school, his art teacher was that lady.
Oh, wow.
It was the little girl from Night of the Living Dead.
And I had a conversation once with Chili Billy Cardelli.
Chili Billy. Yeah, every time I watch this movie, because I grew up in Pittsburgh, and Chili Billy Cardelli, which makes it sound we sound like we're both just losing our minds. What the hell is a Chili Billy Cardelli?
Yeah.
Chili Billy Cardell, he was Pittsburgh's late night horror movie host. You know, Count Floyd from SNL was supposedly based off of this guy. I mean, Count Floyd from SNL is obviously kind of like a pastiche of that, kind of like you know, a couple, like, we're going to host the Dracula movie from midnight to 2 a.m., that kind of thing. And he did that in Pittsburgh. He had a show called Chiller Theater, which is kind of most famous because I guess when Saturday Night Live became a thing, Chiller Theater was an NBC, it was a show shown in Pittsburgh's NBC affiliate, and Chiller Theater was so popular in Pittsburgh that Pittsburgh's NBC affiliate refused to show Saturday Night Live for like the first two years it was on the air, and eventually became popular enough, they were like, Chilly Billy, we're gonna have to take your show off the air because everyone wants to see Bill Murray, they don't want to see you so much these days. But I don't know if Chiller Theater had started by the time when...
I had never seen it. I just knew him by reputation and from this film. He plays a newscaster in this.
Yeah, and he's the, yeah. But if he was the weatherman, though, after Chiller Theater got shut down, he became that same station's the weatherman. Especially, imagine Grandpa from Gremlins 2 if after... He was the vampire guy. He suddenly got a job as the weatherman at that same place. That's essentially what happened to Chilly Billy.
Well, weather in Pittsburgh is terrifying.
Which, yeah, sometimes you get tornadoes. Sometimes you get some pretty crazy weather in Pittsburgh. And so I always get really happy when I watch this movie because I'm like, oh, it's my favorite weatherman. He's just randomly just interviewing people on the steps of the Pentagon in the middle of the day, even though this live footage that we're watching, you know, the people watching this footage, you know, it's like midnight. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But
he's credited in the movie as Chilly Billy, so that he must have had some either a program or some reputation before the film was made, because he already
his show had already started by then, I know it ended in like 1981 or whatever, and his daughter is the star of Dawn of the Dead.
No, Day of the Dead. Day of the Dead.
Day of the Dead. Oh. They both start with D. They're the same movie. Whatever. Yeah, I'm gonna be doing that this whole podcast. My apologies.
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah.
Well, if we talk about horror, let's talk about horror, what it was like before Night of the Living Dead. And we need to stress that, you know, we're living in an era, I don't know if it's a golden age or a silver age or some kind of like a tin age, I don't know. But like, there is a real horror boom going on right now. And
elevated horror.
Yeah, well, you can put an adjective on there if you want. But I think it's safe to say that the horror landscape before Night of the Living Dead is nigh unrecognizable to modern audiences, because it's just completely different.
Okay? What are you talking about? Just because it was all just like spooky castles.
I mean, yes, lots of gothic horror, lots of classic novel adaptations. Of course, you've got, you know, way back in the 30s, of course, you had the Universal Monster films, Dracula, Frankenstein, the Mummy. Then years later in the 50s and 60s, you know, you had the Hammer films, Hammer's Dracula, Hammer's Frankenstein, which I know, James, you've talked about many times on your podcast, Sin and Olivia.
Oh, yeah.
You also got things like...
Love me some Hammer.
Roger Corman's Edgar Allan Poe adaptations. I know I recently saw the Fall in the House of Usher. I thought that was fantastic. Loved that movie.
I need to watch those more often. You know?
Yeah,
fantastic,
really.
Fantastic films.
Really great. But like, so these movies, yes, they're scary. People die. There's violence. But like, there's not really any gore. And it's more about the performances. It's more about the mood. It's more about the atmosphere. You know, if there's a monster, it's probably, you know, just someone wearing a mask or something. Like, there's not a lot of, you know.
But it's totally Count Chocula. Like, it's that kind of stuff.
I would say the only stuff at the before Night of the Living Dead that kind of is close to this is stuff that was coming out of Italy. And not just Gallows, but like Mario Bava was making like graphic horror.
Was he? Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Like Blood and Black Lace. Black Sabbath.
Is that like
Black
proto
Sunday.
Giallo stuff?
Some of it's Giallo, but like Black Sabbath.
Just the title makes it sound like that. Yeah.
Yeah, but Black Sabbath is not a Giallo. It's like a ghost story anthology that has an absolutely terrifying statement with Boris Karloff.
But it makes sense that like that would be Italy, and the Hammer you have chugging along in the UK, and those are both filmmaking environments that aren't stymied by the Hays Code and all this stuff in America that keeps you from really kind of showing messed up stuff.
Yeah,
because
Hammer
in the '50s and '60s,
Hammer took off once they established a rating system in England.
Oh, really?
And, yes.
Oh, okay, but then they had the wherewithal. They could say, okay, we can rate this higher, so we don't
exactly.
have to, we don't have to make this for 10-year-old. Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
The first Hammer Frankenstein film was I think the equivalent of an X rating.
Hmm. Was it still shown that way, or they didn't have to edit it?
They didn't edit it. It was released.
Oh, wow, okay.
That was the draw. The draw was make these movies graphically violent.
Well, I know it's also a little bit different because I know America was really unfortunate that when they did establish the rating system here, the MPA, what, like a month after Night of the Living Dead came out?
Yes, a week
unfortunately,
after.
unfortunately, the rating set aside for movies like Night of the Living Dead, where it's supposed to be violence, the X rating got immediately taken over by porno productions. And so everyone, you couldn't release an X-rated horror movie because everyone just assumed it was pornographic and then, yeah, no theaters would show it and just, and so, yeah, kind of, in America, horror films with real violence were kind of shut out. And that becomes a big thing with Dawn of the Dead. Yeah. Dawn of the Dead a decade
later. Dawn of the Day.
So on the flip side there, you've also got, I would say, science fiction. You've got a lot of monster movies, like, you know, giant ants, giant bugs, creatures from the underground, creatures from outer space.
The Tingler, William Castle. Yeah.
Exactly. William Castle, a lot of gimmick movies that are based on, spooking you. I mean,
kind of doing more interesting thing than horror movies of the time. Because, it's also a new genre with all the radio science horror. And, that's a really good point, actually. Yeah.
You know, we think about these films like, Night of the Living Dead being the first quote-unquote modern horror film. To people in the 50s, them was scary.
Yeah, I was going to say,
We don't think it's scary now. I watched them. I did an episode on my podcast about them. I watched them when I was a kid, and I loved it. Did not scare me. When my dad saw them, it gave him nightmares. He was like 5 years old.
I mean, Godzilla's reputation in Japan. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. Yeah. What do you guys know about Japan? I'm going to tell you guys about Japan right now. says the one guy recording from the 4th of July midnight here in America. But,
it's actually – it's a good point, Bill. You mentioned the Godzilla and the kaiju movies. Those, those started in the 50s, so those are already out there. But those also got real silly real fast.
That only immediately, yeah.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Well, to be fair, Dawn of the Dead's pretty silly, too, but it's not –
kind of silly.
Yeah, Day of the Dead doesn't end with, the zombies, being like, we're going to be the heroes and protect this little kid. They didn't quite get as goofy as the Godzilla movies did very quickly, but yeah.
And, of course, if we're talking about monster movies, horror movies, science fiction, we have to mention Ed Wood because most of Ed Wood's most famous films were intended to be – science fiction, Bride of the Monster.
I forgot that Plan 9 is a zombie movie.
Plan 9 from Outer Space is about, aliens coming to Earth and resurrecting the recently dead. It was supposed to be scary. It's just not.
Yeah. Night of the Living Dead, if we haven't mentioned it, it is the first film to have people come back to life and eat people. Maybe there's something before that's really small that no one talks about, but it is the first one to really cover that. They don't call them zombies. They call them ghouls.
Yeah. Well, I guess at this point we should also point out that technically zombies before, and I'm sure George Romero wasn't the first person to kind of twist the meaning of the word. I mean, you guys said that they don't even mention the word zombie in the movie, but everyone else kind of around the movie kind of twisted the meaning of the word zombie for him. But yeah, originally zombies were a Haitian voodoo thing about resurrecting dead people and stuff like that. And I mean, you did have movies like Bela Lugosi was in a movie called White Zombie.
Yes.
But that was not about flesh-eating monsters. It was about just resurrected, But it's Night of the Living Dead that kind of changes the meaning of the word zombie in Western culture, essentially. Even though they never actually say the word. And I think there's a weird bugaboo with so many other zombie movies afterwards about whether or not they use the word zombie. I know it's a big deal even in Shaun of the Dead and stuff, and I never quite understood that.
Yeah, they finally say it. Ken Foree says zombie once in Dawn of the Dead.
Oh, does he?
He says there are about 100 zombies down here.
Oh, wow. Okay, I never really pegged that.
Yeah.
But I've seen other movies make a big production about don't say the Z word. And I'm like, In fact, actually, if anything, if you're a zombie movie these days and you actually acknowledge the existence of zombie movies, you've already won me a little bit over because it drives me nuts in so many zombie movies where they have to pretend that they're inventing the whole zombie genre where they're like, oh, those creatures. Just admit that, okay, you guys, these characters live in a – in The Walking Dead, did they ever mention Night of the Living Dead or anything like that?
No. And they call them walkers.
Yeah. So, but they never call them zombies. I'm sure maybe over the course of like 3,000 episodes they call them zombies. But anyway, but yeah.
Well, I think the problem with that sort of energy is if you make a horror film and the characters quickly identify what the problem is, then you have to sort of debate, okay, so does the fictions that other people have seen, do they exist in this reality or not? And it gets confusing. So I think they try to avoid it.
Well, but like you think about a vampire movie, they'll say, hey, he's a vampire. People know how vampires work.
Yeah. I'm assuming that's like what half of that Renfield movie is, because that seems to be, even though that's supposed to be canonically a sequel to the 1931 Dracula with Bela Lugosi, I don't know how that works out, but well, and that's not to turn this into a podcast, but a whole different movie, but that's one of my favorite things about Return of the Living Dead, is that movie starts off with a guy saying, hey, did you ever see Night of the Living Dead? That was a real thing that actually happened. And
yeah,
and they talk about Night of the Living Dead and zombies and stuff like that. And yeah, that I love how meta that movie gets. And that's only, like what, like less than 20 years out from this movie. So.
Yeah, something like that.
It's a very clever twist to put in there. Anyway, I have a quote here from George Romero on this topic who said, I never thought about my guys as zombies when I made the first film. To me, zombies were those boys in the Caribbean doing the wet work for Bela Lugosi. So yes, he explicitly talked about White Zombie, which, by the way, just to our audience, if you haven't seen White Zombie, it's real good. It's a good one.
I know
one.
They watch it in Ed Wood, because that's the scene where he's like, she's a honey.
Yeah.
And you have to be Hungarian and double-jointed. Yeah.
Yes. Good flick.
He does wet work from Bela Lugosi. That's a great quote. That sounds like a piece of George Romero dialogue right there.
Very Pittsburghian, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I know Romero's big influence was I Am Legend.
Yes.
Yeah. Which, that's what, not Bradbury.
Richard Matheson,
yeah. Who is the dad of, God, one of the writers from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, weirdly enough, I believe.
Okay, sir.
But yeah, I Am Legend is just a, it's the world's been, I guess everyone's seen, it was called I Am Legend, the Will Smith movie, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you get the gist where it's like, yeah, the world's been taken over by zombies and he's the last human being. And even though the movie takes a lot of liberties with the book, that's the gist of, yeah, I guess maybe that's inspired them to say, hey, let's do a movie about flesh-eating ghouls, I guess?
Because in the I Am Legend book and in the version with Vincent Price from the 60s,
oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
The kind of like vampires, and it's like they say in the movie that it's a virus that maybe came from vampire bats, but the victims of the virus die, then come back.
Huh. Which I guess is kind of like vampires, but also, man, also, I love that the Night of the Living Dead never really commits specifically to a reason as to why the zombies are coming back. Like, I know they do all the stuff with like the research probe from Venus. Yeah, which I love that also Stephen King kind of steals that for
Maximum Overdrive,
like, yeah 20 years later. But the movie never specifically commits. So there's some vague allusions to it when they're talking to people in Washington, D.C. But yeah, even then, that's kind of very 1950s kind of science fiction justification for what's happening. But they don't spend a lot of time on it because George Romero is smart enough to realize it's not really – no one really cares why this is happening. It's just the fact that it is happening and everyone has to deal with it right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, another quote from George Romero says, I thought I Am Legend was about revolution. I said, if you're going to do something about the revolution, you should start at the beginning. I mean, Richard starts his book with one man left. Everyone in the world has become a vampire. I said, we got to start at the beginning and tweak it up a little bit. I couldn't use vampires because he did. So I wanted to do something that would be an earth-shaking change. Something that was forever. Something that was really at the heart of it. I said, so what if the dead stop staying dead?
And that's it. That's the moment. That's the eureka moment, even though he may have not realized how much of a eureka moment that was. But that's the moment that changes movie horror forever.
Yeah, totally.
Right. So that's the basic blueprint work with. And it just, this movie is sort of the start. Like I said, it's the start of what happened. And then in subsequent films, basically, Romero would sort of expand outwards. And, even though this movie ends on a note that sort of suggests that they're just going to clean this up and they might. Like, they might get back to normal?
They are being super blasé about, like, okay, this is just something that happened over, like, one day. And by,
one
like...
one night. Literally.
Yeah, literally. And by, this is all happening on a Friday night, and by Monday, everything's going to be back to normal, I guess, but...
Yeah. In the sequels, it does not go back to normal.
The best thing. It just keeps on spinning out of control. And that's the nice thing about the sequels, is you can imagine, like, okay, maybe they kind of fix things in at that farmhouse... but maybe, like, you know, and what's going on in the inner cities, and that's what Dawn of the Dead starts off being. And then with the third one, it's like, well, society's gone, now we're just living underground. And then even Land of the Dead, I still, even though I don't care for that movie, I like the idea that, you know, it being about, like, what happens once the rich people have kind of managed to create a little oasis for themselves and pretend, or now pretending that the zombies, the zombie thing doesn't, is not really going on anymore. But, mm-hmm. And well, that's kind of the interesting about, not to go off on a tangent, I'm going to shut up after this, but that's one of the nice things I do like about George Romero too, is that he's more about, he's more interested in ideas than even individual characters. And that's the thing, he always said he wasn't really a horror person, because the zombies were just a tool to explore social dynamics. And when he would cast his movies, you know, everyone would be like, okay, what's this character? And he was like, I really don't care about the character. The character's performing like a function just to move the story along. But my, like, so you kind of have free will to do whatever you want, because I just like the way you act and you seem like a good fit for this role, but you're kind of free to make up, like, what this character is, kind of like how they're going to behave throughout the film. Because he's just, like, more interested in, like what happens when, in Dawn of the Dead, when you secure it. Man, they're really going nuts with the fireworks out there. My apologies. Jeez. Yeah, I think the zombies are coming. They're pulling out the howitzers. But, like, yeah, he's more concerned about, like, well, even in this movie, like, what happens when just a handful of people have to pull together? And it's just almost like a coincidence that just happens to be about zombies. And yeah, that just happens to be an easy creature they can come up with without any, like, real makeup or special effects or anything like that.
Yeah, you talk about him not really caring about characters. On one of the commentary tracks for this, they ask, someone brings up, why does Ben hit Barbara?
Yeah.
And George says, well, it's because he has to be out of the movie for the next half an hour.
Yeah.
Like, there's no, like, he doesn't really think about it that far through.
He's
like,
not getting into the characters' heads. It's just, yeah, stuff needs to happen.
And,
yeah.
And, like, he didn't even think about, like, I guess one of the only things Dwayne was hesitant to do was that scene because of the racial dynamic. And George didn't even think about that. It's like, no, Barbara has to be unconscious now. Because, and, you know.
Well, that's his direction for her for most of the movie, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, but yeah.
Night, night.
You just have to be a non-entity for everyone, so everyone else can act around you, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
She does hit him first, though, for the record.
To be fair, yes.
Yeah.
Although it's kind of like a slap, and he does, like, kind of sock her a little bit. Yeah. It's pretty, like,
it's pretty brutal.
I was watching it last night, I had to rewind it, like, because I wasn't really paying attention to the movie, I was, like, checking Twitter, and I heard, like, good sock, and I was like, what the hell was that? I was like, oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't say it's equitable. I'm just saying.
I don't know. Yeah, we're not defending him. We're just saying that. Yeah,
she gets real angry, and
but the characters are plot devices. They're not really characters. Yeah.
Actually, it's funny you mentioned the characters of. So there actually was. I didn't write it down here, but Romero actually once compared himself. He's called himself the Michael Moore of horror, which is kind of a funny a funny nickname.
Okay.
Just because, you know, I guess if your movies are trying to say something, then I get that. I don't know. I mean, Michael Moore, you know, clearly from Flint, Michigan, so totally different guy, but yeah. I don't know.
Working class city, though.
I would say George Romero has affected more chains of society than Michael Moore has, but hey, that's just me. I have Michael Moore's autograph. I've met that
I
man.
Love I think, it's the fans that can talk the most shit. I know that feeling. Shit. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I guess we can actually talk about the movie itself, although there's not that much to say, like, beat for beat, because it's a very simple story, you know?
Yeah.
It starts off real fast. I would say in the first 10 minutes, you meet Barbara, you meet Johnny, they're in a cemetery, a man walks up to them, he's dead, he's not happy about it, and Barbara runs away, she runs into a house, Ben shows up, like, this is all in, like, the first 10 or 15 minutes, it goes very fast.
Yeah.
And the movie kind of hits the brakes, and you get a very long, you know, stretch of securing the house, people talking to one another, people telling stories to one another about what they've seen, what's happening elsewhere. They turn the radio on, they hear what's happening in other towns.
The big crutch of the second act is that while Ben and Barbara are in this house defending themselves and cleaning it up and boarding it up, they don't know there's a whole, there's five people in the basement.
Yeah. You could totally kind of feel Romero being like getting to the end of that first act and going, well, what's the rest of the story? I've got these two people in a house. Like, what can I do? And then he must have been like, what if there's a whole family hiding in the basement? And that you know, and that's kind of drives the drama for the whole rest of the movie. But yeah.
Yeah. And the whole drama is there's a family in the basement and they think the basement is safe. But
I mean, that's an interesting conversation they have throughout the film. But like, yeah, is it better to hide downstairs? Is it better to stay up? Yeah. Just trying to normal people strategizing is an interesting thing to see. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it turns out the dipshit in this movie is right. Cooper.
Yeah.
I mean, his technically what he's saying in that movie turns out to be, I mean, that's what saved Ben's ass at the end of the movie.
It's a really complex story in that, like, the hero, like, I mean, if you haven't seen this movie, go watch it. You can watch it on YouTube or anywhere. If a streaming service doesn't have this movie, they messed up because, as we'll get to it, it's very easy to get. The most interesting thing about the film is that the conflict is that the hero is wrong. And very stubbornly so. And every idea the quote-unquote good guys have is terrible.
Mm-hmm. To be fair, of course, watching a zombie movie, you're always going to be thinking, like, what would I do in that situation? And, if I were honest, I would probably be doing the Ben thing, too. And then again, you know, I have a lifetime of watching zombie movies, so not that real life is the same thing as a zombie movie, but
I'd be dead. That's all there is to it. So
I'm a big, fat, dopey white guy. I would be one of the fat zombies on the opening credits. Like, oh, look at this sad sack. Like, yeah, he didn't even make it past the catering credit in the opening credits. But you got
Cooper and his wife and his kid, and then the young couple together. And the young couple's kind of like the intermediary, trying to work between Ben and Cooper.
The useless young couple.
Yeah.
Who only exists just to die, because you have to have someone die, but you still need that friction between Ben and Cooper to keep on going toward, you know, even to the climax of the film. And so, yeah, hot lady, hot generic lady, and then hot little fire plug of a man who looks like the kid from Jurassic Park who talks about the Velociraptor looking like a 6-foot turkey.
I like in the remake, which has issues, but I like that they gave that character a Steelers hat because
I've tried to sit through the remake and I could never do it. But
well, in the remake, that dude is the most Yinzer who ever Yinzered.
That'd be great. That's a good idea. That's a good yeah.
Yeah, Yinzer is a Pittsburghian, but yeah, he's very Yinzery.
Like Pittsburgh dad coming up from the basement. Yeah, hey, yeah, totally. You guys want anything from John Eagle?
Yeah, you want go steal his net anyway. sorry, Diamond. Sorry,
they got
Diamond.
Zombies at the Kennywood.
Yeah. Gonna bed that place up. Anyway, sorry.
Bed that place up. They're all messed up over there. Diamond, if you ever want to know what a Pittsburgh accent sounds like, it's pretty much the, like, I think they call him the sheriff. The guy who is, like, he leading the hunting party.
Yeah, yeah.
That guy's accent is a Pittsburgh accent where he's just like, the Pittsburgh accent is kind of, it's hard to describe. It's just such a specific thing.
It's
look
so
it up
stupid.
On YouTube sometimes.
It's so stupid. Like, I don't have a Pittsburgh. I don't live there. My voice is strange for different reasons. I have genetic conditions. My voice is not a Pittsburgh accent, everybody listening at home. No. But Pittsburgh accent is it's one of those things that, like, not everybody in Pittsburgh has it, but when you meet someone that has it.
I mean,
it,
I grew
like,
up there and I don't have it, but
yeah, like, you meet somebody, if they're unironically saying yins.
Yins.
Then it's like, oh shit, it's gonna get real.
Yins is the Pittsburgh version of y'all. That's
yeah,
all it is.
That's all it is. Anyway, but yins in the house have trouble with the zombies. Bad things happen.
But really, there's a good chunk of the movie where the zombies basically take a back seat. They're outside of the house. You know, they stick their arm in a window maybe, or they break something, but they're basically in the back seat, and the real conflict is between the people in the house. And
that's obviously stuff that Romero is actually interested in. Yeah.
Right. And, you know,
and
the zombies.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The zombies only resurface as a threat because they try to escape and the escape attempt goes very badly. And then.
Because Ben puts down a torch and then the fire plug guy, he just kind of like whips this gasoline pump around and catches the truck on fire. And the girl's like, my coat's stuck. And then they explode, and that's your barbecue at the gas pump that you mentioned. Yeah.
If folks, there's a reason they say no smoking at the gas pump. It's because of this movie.
Oh yeah, that's you get to see exactly why right there. Yeah.
Yeah. It goes, and then that's when you get I think the most infamous scene when the movie came out was that scene, because then you see the zombies eat them.
Oh yeah, you have people just sitting in like you have like naked people sitting in the grass eating raw chicken breasts, or like big bone and ham, like cartoon Fred Flintstone chunks of meat. Yeah,
the meat's interesting because it's a combination of it's props. Like there's an obvious fake arm.
Right. Yeah.
Some of it is real animal bones with like chocolate syrup and silly putty. and my favorite though is the intestines are pig intestines. But they didn't look alive, so they tied the ends and filled them with water.
Oh, no.
And there's a great story, again, on the commentary.
That's worse than if they were... that's somehow even worse.
The commentary for this on the Criterion is from the old Laserdisc in 94. And it's a really good one for Mero. And he's like, he said it was one of the most surreal things he ever saw was it might have been Jack just sitting on the porch pouring water into intestines. and it's like, I thought I walked through a Fellini film.
This is movie making.
It was
bizarre.
Yeah.
Well, that becomes a thing for future George Romero zombie movies where it's like, okay, I guess we're going to be paying people extra bucks if you're willing to eat these pig intestines that have been sitting under the hot lights of the soundstage for like, 5 hours. And, which, I mean, those are the money shots of the movie. So it makes sense that they're going to have a fun time shooting that stuff. Maybe not these people because they had no idea what the hell they were doing out there.
It's really fun when you watch the movie and you see what zombies actually do and what zombies don't actually do. So I know the intestine scene you're seeing. Like two zombies fight over the intestines, and then one of them sort of wins. But because they are intestines, he doesn't actually eat them. He just sort of grabs them and puts them towards his face, but he never actually eats them.
There is supposedly it's the same lady who plays the mom in the family in the basement. There is a lady who's got like a bunch of Play-Doh on her face. I guess she's supposed to be like a burn victim. I don't know why they had one of the main actors pretend to be another zombie out in the field. But yeah, she just like kind of stumbles up to a tree and eats a bug. And it looks like she actually eats the bug. They don't really cut away, or at least maybe they cut away the fraction before she like sticks the bug in her mouth. But
yeah, for the time, very gruesome. Yeah,
and that lady, I always feel kind of bad because she always seems like such a nice lady, and they have her like half naked out in the woods eating a bug on a tree, and I'm like, man, I can see why she wasn't in movies for 30 more years after this.
And then Sinbad,
and then Sinbad, because she was passionate about the material. But yeah, that's kind of where everything. They kind of come back to the house and the zombies. I guess maybe it's because that lures the zombies kind of back to the house that there's one last attack of the zombies.
Yeah.
And that's when everything really, like, really pretty much the moment they decide to, like, enact the plan of taking the truck out. And that's when everything really just dominoes and everything begins to really fall apart. But,
And this is the part when I was a kid that messed me up was when Johnny gets Barbara at the very end. And when she's just absorbed into the hands of all the zombies.
Well,
and
it's weird, too, because she recognizes it's Johnny. And I do like I have seen that, like, the whole reason they have Johnny put on the racing gloves at the beginning of the movie is they wanted to make sure he was recognizable as a zombie when he comes back later. Because they knew he probably wouldn't have his glasses on. His hair would be messed up. They were like, okay, well, at least when you see the racing gloves, you recognize, like, it's Johnny. And she screams, but she kind of doesn't seem like she's totally fighting getting pulled away either. Because she's so, I don't want to say she's happy about seeing Johnny, but it's open interpretation is exactly how she's reacting.
I think she's given up.
Maybe that could be it as much as anything else. Yeah. But and she just kind of gets dragged away. And she was kind of the main character at the start of the movie.
Yeah. The movie is nonstop action for 10 minutes, a lot of dialogue, and then some of the most intense, messed up things you would see in 1968.
And the soundtrack is all just like atonal. And you're like, what the hell am I watching? Like, I mean, this is an entirely different kind of film. Because I know a lot of people talk about how Psycho is like, what, 1961, 1960?
Yeah.
And how, I know some people will say, well, that's the first modern horror movie, but that is still a studio product of the studio system and has like an original score with a lush orchestra. This is just barely bolted together batshit stuff. And like, just like all these people, like half of them aren't even actors, getting eaten alive. Got naked people out in the forest pretending to eat chicken breast. The soundtrack they just found from some random library music, just going, it is like surreal as hell. And there's a great review from, who's the lady who would yell? Pauline Kael, where she's all like, this movie, she calls out the fact the movie, like, is barely competently put together, but she also highlights, like, the artlessness in this movie kind of wins you over, because the artlessness kind of fuels the horror, because it even feels a little more like a documentary that way, because it is just so unpolished and messed up, and yeah, and that really comes to a head right here at this part of the movie, and just even, like, so, was it Cooper? Oh, there's a big kerfuffle over the gun.
Yeah, and then yes. Ben kills Cooper. I was going to ask you, Diamond, you're a parent.
Yes.
How do you feel what when you watch this movie now as a parent, and Ben goes downstairs and sees the daughter eating her dad, or mom, yeah, eating dad first, and stabbing mom with a garden trowel?
Yeah.
Does that hit differently? It's like,
I mean, I definitely, you know, I've watched some movies for my kids that were definitely not for kids, mm-hmm. but I feel like at this point, you know, growing up in the era that where they've grown up with, I feel like they can take a lot more that I couldn't take at their age. Mm-hmm. But I certainly did not watch this movie in front of them. And mm-hmm. I don't know how old they should be before they see this. Because, yeah, it's pretty messed up to see the kid come for mom and then she eats dad. And
dad goes down quick, though. Like,
yeah.
He was already shot.
He's only out for like 2 seconds, and the mom comes down. His arm's already ripped off.
But when the mom says this, oh baby, and like it's just so it's hard for me to watch it.
And
still.
Well, the reason I even jumped to this part so quickly is just the sound of her screaming as she's being and the ka-chunk ka-chunk. Even though it's obviously just like Bosco Hershey syrup just flung on the walls and stuff like that, it is still just like, the hell am I watching? This is not Chocula cobweb bullshit anymore. This is like visceral, literally visceral. Like, yeah, this is, I could see why this stuff caused people to lose their goddamn minds in 1968, because it is just like, and there's no story reason, there's no moral to any of this. It's just random mayhem and just good people being punished for no reason.
It's hopeless.
And it's just, oh, man. But it's not like grimdark. Romero's not trying to be like, am I blowing your mind?
No.
He's not being pretentious about it either. He's just like, this is what happened. Isn't this messed up? And you're like, yeah, this is messed up. Yeah.
I remember a great quote from Romero, I think, during Dawn, where he was like, he is convinced society could break down for something like this, because he's like, mm-hmm. go to a McDonald's, order a plain cheeseburger, see if they get it right.
Yeah.
They won't.
Just,
so then imagine that before something that matters.
It's the thing that when people start freaking out, it's the thing that you just expect that works every day. And when that stops working, then you just realize, I mean, what would we know about that, living through a 3-year pandemic now, about things kind of like always kind of like feeling like they're 5 minutes away from falling apart, which mm-hmm. actually that does kind of lend an extra kind of tinge of a little bit yanking the collar here a little bit watching this movie, because even though I joked about how as a kid this movie didn't do anything to me, because I was like, oh, it's just silly black and white, just goofy, like people goofing around in the woods, watching it as an adult now, it's a little bit like, and I'm not even a parent in the stuff with the kid and the killing of the parents and the, although I did, supposedly the original idea was that Cooper was supposed to die, and because his daughter was knocked out from her injuries, he was supposed to turn into a zombie and start eating her, and then the mom would go down there and then stuff would happen.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if that's true. Now, I could see that being kind of almost more messed up.
That's more messed up.
Yeah, but because they would have had showing the dad eat the daughter, and that would be even more, for the parents at least, that would be extra just like, oh my. But still, whatever, the finished film, just, oh man. And it's not even the worst of it. Within the worst of it is the end of the movie. And that's the extra just most like, what the hell was that? Krusty the Clown, what the hell was that? Doc Giff. Yeah.
Well, we mentioned kids, so I think this is probably a great time to mention the very famous writer from Roger Ebert, who documented his experience watching this movie at a matinee.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as we said, horror was not really seen as an adult genre. It was seen as very family friendly, with a few exceptions. Most of these movies were playing during the day, and
I mean, by 68, horror was like, little kids in Boris Karloff Frankenstein masks. It was the monsters.
This opened on a double bill with the Peter Cushing Doctor Who movie.
That's right up there with My Neighbor Totoro and Grave of the Fireflies. That is the American version of that. Yeah, well, I guess American-British co-production, but yeah. Oh, so, man.
Roger Ebert, you know, noticed that, you know, there was a large number of kids, like more kids in the audience than adults. And he wrote in the story, which is like late 68, early 69, he says, "I don't think younger kids really knew what hit them. They were used to going to the movies, sure. And they'd seen some horror movies before, sure. But this was something else. This was ghouls eating people up. And you could actually see what they were eating. This was little girls killing their mothers. This was being set on fire. Worst of all, even the hero got killed."
Yeah, because at the end, Bendis gets unceremoniously shot in the head and put on a fire.
And no one knows his story. He's completely anonymous. And just like, I know that's the whole reason why this movie really, especially kind of blew up in Europe, because all the French people were like, "Oh, he's a black man. He was killed by the white people and their dogs. It looks like Alabama." But I mean, they're not wrong. But like, even regardless of race or anything like that, that is such a damn bleak ending. And even when he gets shot, is there even a big sting of music? It's just so matter-of-factly. Nope. He gets shot and that's it. And I love when right after that, then they just cut to the still photo. So you're almost just like looking at the photos as they would have appeared in the newspapers. And the fact that like even that montage with the still photographs at the end starts off with all the guys with the meat hooks. And they don't even show you what they're using the meat hooks for, but your brain fills in that information. You could just imagine them just sinking the meat hooks and all these dead bodies and Ben's being hauled around by the meat hooks and the bonfire and like the sound of the helicopter over the end, and just it's just like it is legitimately fantastic filmmaking there at that end. I still don't think George Romero was that technically good of a filmmaker, but he had fantastic instincts. Mm-hmm. And that it's just pure, I can't even describe it. It's just pure emotional, a live wire of energy captured, especially at the end of this film. That's really hard to communicate to other people.
And I feel it has to be, for 1969 or 68, one of the most nihilistic experiences you could possibly experience in a movie theater.
Yeah. If Krusty the Clown was, what the hell was that? And that was the parents' reaction. The kids' reaction must have been like when the Gummo doll gets thrown into the crowd and they start screaming.
I'm glad
that's Gummo, Gummo scream.gif. Yeah.
I'm glad that Doctor Who was a second movie.
That's not a very good movie either.
No, it's not, but it's fun.
Peter Cushing got to play Doctor Who, but
yeah, it's a fun little B movie. Yeah.
Doctor, not even the Doctor, but just Doctor D-R Doc.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
The end. Yeah.
Man, yeah, that's a, don't want to swear, but that's a pretty, that's that movie, that's all messed up.
Well, for the record, you know, since we do mention the fact that this is 1968, and this is the year that Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and killed. People did ask about that, and for the record, George Romero said that his movie was already in the can when that happened. So they did all their filming.
Yeah, I think he said he was showing it to distributors when they got the news.
They literally put it in the can that day. They were taking it to a distributor when they were driving to New York.
Although you still had the whole civil rights thing, and like you know, like even if Martin Luther King hadn't been assassinated, that whole movie would have still been good. But the Martin Luther King thing definitely put a button on that though. But yeah, oh man.
Yeah, a lot of the civil rights like subtext of this, a lot of it is the audience brings that in. That was not intended by Romero. He wasn't against it, but it wasn't like he was not.
It's something he accidentally backed into without meaning to. And I mean, what's the Robert Ebert quote that movies are just empathy machines? Mm-hmm. And that's right there. That's it. And it's not even like a racial parable or anything like that. The fact that he's black is it even mentioned at all? Even like highlighted in the film at all in any way?
Nothing. No.
He's just another human being. That alone is for 1968. Regardless of the quality of the movie aside, it's a black guy as the functional lead of a film, and it's not a plot point. It's never brought up. Yeah.
Yeah. Even as Ben and Cooper, you know, argue with one another, and they get very heated, and they start fighting with one another.
Waiting for something to drop, though. If this is the first time you're watching it, it's like,
No, it doesn't come up, and Cooper, you know, Cooper's clearly very angry. Cooper very much wants to be right, and he's very stubborn, but you can see there's no, I mean, if you want to put the subtext there, you can put the subtext there, but certainly there's no text there.
There's nothing there that the filmmakers or the actor seem to have put in.
Right.
Yeah. And, I didn't even think about how that's kind of remarkable in itself. Yeah.
And a black guy punching a white guy. also, like in addition to the scene
punching, punching a white lady and punching a white guy, and then murdering a boy guy.
Yeah. And then being on, I think it was Jack Russo saw this movie in a movie, in a predominantly black movie theater. And when Ben was killed, he's like, I got to get out of here.
It's not a bad idea. At least
they're not happy.
At least. Oh, man. I never even thought about how that must be one hell of a quiet movie theater at the end of that.
Oh,
like,
God.
Just.
Yeah.
I know, watching it at home, I was kind of stunned silent at the ending. I was like, oh, geez, that's how it goes out, huh?
That's kind of, but then Dawn of the Dead 10 years later, it's like this raucous Super Bowl music at the end while the black guy's punching out zombies and juking them out and doing kung fu. And like, I do love that, like, at the end of Dawn of the Dead, Romero goes, we can't have two movies on the same week, because that was supposed to be another movie where everyone dies at the end.
Yeah.
And they were like, you know, we just can't. Especially because the last guy just survived at the end of the Dawn of the Dead is supposed to be a black guy. And there's a whole... People argue as to whether or not this was intentional or just something that Romero, again, just accidentally backed into. But at least in the first four zombie movies that he made, technically the heroes are all black. Because you've got Ben in this movie. You've got Ken Foray in Dawn. You've got... Wait, that falls apart with Day of the Dead, though, right?
One of the survivors is a black guy.
Yeah.
Yes, he's Caribbean. I forgot where.
But then the zombie, the mechanic zombie in Land of the Dead, who becomes the hero kind of by de facto. But so maybe that, yeah, maybe that there is a more argument that because it's not consistent, it's something that George Romero just kind of accidentally kept on backing into. But it says four white people talking about racial stuff. But
well, Bill, you can certainly point out that as far as I can recall, none of Romero's zombie movies are really focused on white men. You know what I mean? There's white men in the movies, but they're never really the focus. You know, it's usually a woman or a person of color. Mm-hmm. Usually.
That's a good point.
You know, I mean, you've got, this movie, you've got Ben and you've got Barbara.
I mean, that's where Day of the Dead works on that, because the main character is like, Bill Cardill's. I can't remember her name. Linda Cardill?
I forget. Yeah.
And Day of the Dead, but yeah. But yeah, does that carry through? Have you guys seen his? Well, no, that's right, because you said that you had seen all the other ones except for one of them, right, James?
Well, Land has, what's his name? Is that Thomas Jane?
I think, because there's the one mechanic zombie. I know George Romero said that he considers him to be the hero of that film.
No, it's Simon Baker, somebody else, not Thomas Jane. That's the mentalist. Yeah, the mentalist is the guy with the mentalist. He's the main character, but it also has Azio Argento and John Leguizamo.
I forgot Johnny Legs is in there, yeah.
And the bad guy basically playing George W. Bush is Dennis Hopper.
That's right.
There is that. And then Survival of the Dead, I don't know who she is, but...
Is that the found footage one?
That's the found footage one.
Okay,
and the protagonist of that film is also a woman.
Okay.
I have not seen... No, that's Diary. I'm sorry. That's Diary of the Dead. That's the found footage
one.
Oh,
that makes sense. If it's the found footage, it would be called Diary of the Dead.
And I have not seen Survival of the Dead, so I can't speak for that.
And that's one thing, like, George Romero always seemed to be, like, a real humanist kind of guy. And it didn't seem to have too many baked-in prejudice, at least nothing that I've ever heard about. Yeah. Not to hold him, God knows, I'm sure he had his own problems and stuff. But yeah, I mean, that's a really good example of someone who born out of that era. It was very humanist and seemed to kind of view everything on... Like, he didn't have much of an agenda to push in terms of, like, yeah, I like the fact that he was fine with, like, you know, women and black folks and, like, anyone could be a hero. But then again, part of that is because he didn't care about character so much as much as societal breakdown stuff. He was always more worried about the larger issues rather than individual characters, and which, like, gave his actors a lot of room to kind of do stuff like that. But
he's equally indifferent.
but when people I was born in so-and-so age as an excuse for the racism these days, you point to people like George Romero, but like, that guy was he made the first modern horror movie in 1968, and like, he was not even pushing a specific agenda. He just accidentally made this really race conscious kind of film, and yeah, I don't know, but monkey pants.
Diamond, want to move on to like the release and stuff, or
absolutely yes. I want to talk about how this movie was you know, was received at the time, because we do have, you know, we mentioned the Paulina Kyle was certainly impressed by it. Roger Ebert was sort of more surprised. I don't think he was necessarily, you know,
like
into
he was
movies,
more freaked out by that showing than anything about the movie itself.
He
yeah.
liked the movie and was not calling for censorship, but he was different. Yes. He used that review to talk about how we need to use the rating system.
Absolutely.
Which the rating system kicked in like a month after Night of Living Dead.
He was right.
And that was the whole thing, is because a bunch of kids could see the movie because it was unrated. And there's a whole, I put this in the notes for this episode, but there's a whole thing to be said about how Night of the Living Dead comes at the end of the 60s, where like the studio filmmaking system was falling apart, and the old Hays Code system that ruled the content that went into the studio system films was dying, and that's why they had to replace it with the MPAA new rating system, you know, like G, PG, you know, eventually PG-13 R-rated and stuff. And yeah, it's just funny, that whole decade was such a churn of business changes in the industry, the death of the studio system, the rise of all these independents, and Night of the Living Dead was just right there, just a hit right at the right time. And I'm going to shut up and let the Diamond talk.
Certainly, the famous critic for the New York Times, Vincent Canby, was not impressed by Night of the Living Dead. We have a quote here saying, "A grainy little movie acted by what appear to be non-professional actors who are besieged in a farmhouse by some other non-professional actors who stagger around, stiff-legged, pretending to be flesh-eating ghouls."
He's not wrong.
No, yeah, he's not wrong. And but he's a little disdainful.
And he's one of the only critics who would have viewed it.
Oh, that's another point, too, because it wasn't like that above board thing about like,
When I was searching through newspaper archives for all of 69, I could find very few reviews of this film.
Yeah.
It just was not on their radar. But while it was not on any critics' radar, it was just making boku bucks.
Well, it is funny. If you look up on the New York Times website to this day, there is a capsule review which cites Vincent Canby. So I don't know where he wrote this, but, you know, they say he wrote this, and it's a very short, "Revolting garbage, though a camp cult favorite. Help yourself."
I mean,
sounds about right. For that kind of schmuck.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's revolting garbage. It's great, but like, yeah. I mean, no real horror movie fan's probably going to put up too much of an argument about that, because that's the whole point. We love garbage. We're sewage rats. This is where we live. Get the hell out of here, Vincent Canby. Yeah.
But like, while I couldn't find out any more reviews, it was fun to look in the old newspapers and find out some box office, because this movie made about $5 million in just a couple of years.
God, it was probably made for like, what, like $15,000 or something? Like
yeah,
that?
It was made for not a lot. Pretty soon
Clerks
they realized
money.
They stopped bundling it with Doctor Who, and they bundled it with Blood and Black Lace, which is a very gory film.
Wow.
The Corruption, which is a great Peter Cushing movie, he plays a bad guy, and that's not a Hammer film. And Andy Milligan's The Ghastly Ones, which is just a garbage piece of garbage, which I highly recommend.
It's a Canby over here.
Yes, but yeah, but then it's really interesting because like you can't get any good box office information after like 71, 72, because then they found out, oops, this film's not copyrighted.
Which is funny that it took them that long to figure it out.
Well,
and that's part of the thing that helped its legacy too, was the fact that then it's kind of like what happened with it must have been the destruction of RKO, because RKO made its Wonderful Life, and somehow Wonderful Life got immediately shunted into public domain, not immediately, but eventually, so that it could be shown on television by every station every Christmas 3,000 million times, because they, you know, had airwaves to fill, and kind of Dawn of the Dead wound up kind of benefiting from that Night of the Living Dead. Yeah, because like everyone could just show it on TV. It just became a staple of like late night horror classic stuff, and just release. Yeah, again, George Romero got lucky, even though it kind of robbed him of a shitload of money he could have earned. But the reputation built his. If it hadn't been for Night of Living Dead becoming public domain accidentally, I don't think he gets the career that he gets later on, because I don't think that many people would have been as interested as in Dawn of the Dead later on.
You can call it a happy accident with a silver lining. So it's like it had some good points and some bad points. But yeah, what happened was, this is a fascinating story. So while they were, you know, it went through many titles. There were many different titles as they're working on this. But for a while there, they thought they were going to release it as Night of the Flesh Eaters. So they had credits made up for the film with Night of the Flesh Eaters. But shortly before they released it, they found out there was another film that used that name. So they had to change their name.
That's a pretty pretty specific title, too. I could see why they didn't think to look that up to see if anyone had that. Yeah.
So when they retitled it as Night of the Living Dead, they had to make a new title screen. And in this era, if you didn't actually put the copyright information on your film, it was not copyrighted. That is not the case today. That's not the case today at all. But in 1968, that's how it worked. You had to actually have a copyright symbol on your title screen. So when they changed the title, they, you know, someone forgot to put that on there. And all of a sudden, it became public domain. And yes, this opened the floodgates. Anyone could show it. Anyone could release it. Anyone could edit it. Anyone could remake it. Anyone could do anything with it. And as Romero said many years later, the fact that people were able to show it for free, that anybody was able to distribute it, did result in lots of people seeing it and keeping the film alive. You know?
Okay, well, I feel bad for going off on a tangent now because he just made my argument for me then. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. In our modern era, yeah, as we said, any video service, you know, it's on YouTube. There's dozens of copies on YouTube. You can watch it in full on Wikipedia. You can watch it on Internet Archives. There's many copies. Internet Archives said it is the second most downloaded film in their library, right behind 1938's Sex Madness. So
I own
what?
That.
I've never heard
I
of
own that.
That
movie. I own that movie. It's a bad movie. Okay. Don't watch
that
movie.
Do you own like the actual physical film reels?
No. I will say one thing about public domain, because this happens a few times. This happened with Charade, which is a great old like Hitchcockian type movie.
Oh, and I love a few that other movie.
Yeah, great movie. But the, you know, and copyright law in America is, it benefits corporations too much, obviously.
Yeah, a little bit. Thanks, Disney.
The one defense I'll say for copyright is, so yeah, I mean, in addition to Romero not getting money for this movie that he should have gotten, rightfully so, for the longest time, if you wanted to watch it, the only copies that were available looked like trash because there was no financial incentive to clean it up. To the point where when Criterion decided to put it out, they had to help get funding from like the George Lucas Film
That's
Institute.
The version I watched. I fired up my Criterion disc, and at the beginning it says the George Lucas Family Trust, and I was like, what? And at the end, too, after the movie's over, there was a big burned-in, like, copyright, blah, 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 blah. They made sure that, like, yeah, even aside from whatever's actually on the film print now these days, there's an extra just like, yeah, this is, at least this scan of this movie, this pristine, like, 4K scan, that copyright. You can't
because
mess with that.
They actually went through the hassle of getting the original camera negative and the original audio. And so
digitally cleaned it up and everything.
But you have to think about it. Like, that's not, if you're the financial incentive for that's really low, because why, if you're a regular consumer and you don't know about all this stuff, you'll see, and you, like, what old Criterion's disc cost $30. This disc cost $5. What's the difference? Yeah.
Well, that's the nice thing about Criterion is they know that they have the built-in audience that'll at least make it worthwhile. It may not make a mint off of it, but at least they know some people. And I was one of those people where I already had four copies of that movie sitting on my hard drive, and I was like, well, I'll just buy this one and rip it too. It'll just be sitting on the top of the pile with all the other ones, but yeah.
I know a restored, remastered copy of the film did end up at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. I don't know if they're still showing it today. I who knows what they're doing, exhibiting it or not, but I know they have a pristine copy that I think was produced as part of this restoration process.
Yeah.
So they had at least for a while that they had exhibitions of it in the museum. So that'd be really cool. Obviously, given this film's legacy, I think it's absolutely on your Library of Congress list of, you know, important movies. So at this point, it is rightly viewed as a classic, as a important piece of film history. You know, you can absolutely, you can buy a trashy, you know, $3.99, you know, gas store DVD copy, of course, but there are also people out there making really nice copies, really nice packages out there. It's on DVD, it's on Blu-ray, you know, so if you want to buy a copy, by all means buy a copy, but just maybe do your homework and make sure it's, you know, one of the good ones.
Well, that's, even going back to the Count Chocula era of horror films, Universal, like 10 years ago, put out this fantastic Blu-ray set of 4K, and maybe they were 4K scans.
Yeah, 4K,
But like, like Frankenstein and Dracula and all that stuff, and I watch those things every year for the last decade, and they just, the way they digitally just like still the frame so you don't have that camera judder and it's cleaned up, it's just like, it's unreal how good old movies look. Old black and white movies can look these days in 4K. It is startling. They're just genuinely beautiful. And maybe Night of the Living Dead doesn't look that gorgeous because, you know, it's a little crummy movie, but like, it's a different movie than what you may have seen as a kid, especially if you grew up like watching it on, like, you know, on rabbit ears antenna TV or on VHS. It's like, yeah, it's an almost entirely different presentation these days.
So I wanted to move on to the legacy of this movie because the movie was public domain, because Romero didn't get the money that he rightly deserved for this. Obviously, he was motivated to make sequels, which we'd already talked about. You know, he made many sequels over the years. Although, you know, to his credit, he didn't just churn them out. He usually spent many, many years in between sequels of these films. So, you know, Dawn is like 78, so almost like 10 years later. Day is like 85, so that's many years later. And then Land of the Dead was a full 20 years later. So he took his time making these films. But in 1990, they made the first full-color remake of this film, which Romero has a writing credit on. And it was directed, notably directed by Tom Savini. I think this is the only directing credit, I think.
Yes, it is.
He supposedly had such a terrible time with this, he never wanted to direct again. So, yeah.
But in case our listeners don't know, Tom Savini is just a special effects legend. You know, he made some of the, you know, all-time classic films look the way they look. You know, he worked with Romero on many of his other zombie films. He was not there for Night of the Living Dead, but
He was off in Vietnam, filming. Yeah, he was a combat photographer, I guess.
He's there for Dawn. He's in Dawn. He plays one of the bikers in Dawn of the Living Dead.
He's not a professional actor, but he's usually one of the best parts of every movie that he's in, though. Yeah,
he's Sex Machine in Dust Till Dawn. Yes, yes.
Yeah, he's the guy with a penis gun and From Dusk Till Dawn.
I have stood next to Tom Savini while people came up to him and high-fived him. Hey, Sex Machine! And he loved it. He was drinking that shit, and it was great.
I want to shout out, I recently saw a slasher film from, I want to say, 81 or 82 called Maniac. And in addition to doing the effects, Tom Savini plays a poor sap in that movie who gets a shotgun to the face.
That is one of the best headshots in all of movie done, right?
That is probably the third best exploding head in film history.
Of course you'd have rank as like, well, it's Chopping Mall, it's...
No, it's Scanners, Chopping Mall, that.
Actually, Scanners, that guy's eyeballs and Scanners. Yeah. You slow that, watch that in slow motion, it is hilarious. But anyway.
But, so 1990, we have a full-color, full remake. So Romero has writing credits, so hopefully he gets some money out of this. I would say, shout-out to acting legend, character actor legend, sci-fi legend, horror legend, Tony Todd gets to play Ben. And Patricia Tallman plays Barbara. And you can tell that they definitely wanted to make Barbara a very different character in this remake. I want to say as makeup. Because Barbara in the first film shuts down, she gets knocked out, she panics.
Yeah, you know, a lot of room to improve.
She kind of becomes dead weight. And in the remake, she gets a very terrified opening. You know, she gets attacked in the cemetery, she runs away, but they really purposefully made her a lot more active. She gets to carry the gun, she shoots a lot of people. I would say by the end of the movie, it's her story more than it's Ben's story. And also, Patricia Tallman, not really a famous actor, she's a famous stunt performer. She doubled Laura Dern in Jurassic Park.
She did! Yeah. I only know her from Star Trek. She shows up as like a background person on the bridge for like 30 episodes. Yeah.
She did a lot of stunt performing on television, like Star Trek and that kind of stuff. So she's more famous for being a stunt performer than an actor. So the fact that she played Barbara in the Night of the Living remake really shows how they wanted to make Barbara a little more, you know, kick-ass. Like, it's almost like...
You're convincing me to watch that now.
It's like a pre... You know, this is 1990, so it's almost like a pre-Linda Hamilton T2 kind of thing. Like, you know, all of a sudden, Barbara kicks ass now, you know?
I remember... Because this is back when I was still terrified of zombies. And I remember watching the... Okay, I remember watching the Marsha Warfield talk show.
There was a Marsha Warfield talk show?
Yes.
There was.
And
saying that makes people laugh. But go ahead.
And she was on it, and they showed the clip of her. There's a scene in a movie where she's shooting a zombie to prove it's dead. She's shooting him in the chest. Is he dead yet? Is he dead yet? And that I was 11, and it's like 11. It's like 10:30 on a Tuesday on a summer, and that freaked me the shit out, and I had to stop watching Marsha Warfield. I was so sad. That remake is well made.
I've heard good things.
It takes some liberties with the ending.
Yeah.
That I think are interesting.
I read the synopsis last night in preparation for this, and I did see that they complicated it up more. Yeah.
And I think they do a lot, and it definitely it does give me a much bigger Pittsburgh vibe than the original.
There's a Yunzer in the basement.
And it is the special effects are gruesome. So
yeah, which makes sense. I did watch the beginning on YouTube, and they do a whole thing of like, oh, there's a zombie in the cemetery. No, it's just an old man with a head wound for some reason. But then a Tom Savini caliber zombie shows up.
Yes.
And you could tell, okay, Tom Savini directed. You could totally tell this part. Okay, yeah, this is Tom Savini going nuts, but yeah.
Yeah, I believe they purposely didn't have much makeup on the zombies in the first film just because it was expensive. They wanted, they really didn't have the budget for that kind of thing. So when they make the remake, the zombies look a lot more gruesome. And
also by that time, Tom Savini was so known for his gore makeup. Like, oh, yeah. They had to just go nuts with that, yeah.
I would say it's enjoyable. I enjoyed watching it. It is certainly not on the caliber of the original film, but, you know, I also think one of the most notable things for me is I thought the music was pretty terrible. I mean, you know, we've talked a lot of this episode about how the music for the first film was strange and almost atonal at times, but the music they slapped on that 1990 movie, I think was pretty bad. I'm not
impressed.
Was it
like a score or was it like synth?
It's like a proper score, and I just think it's not good.
No.
And according to Letterboxd, the composer that did the music for Majorettes, and man, Majorettes has really bad music, so that checks out okay. Yeah,
they should have just had a score like Return of the Living Dead, where it's all just like, you know, the cramps and stuff. But
it's one of the only films produced by Golan after Cannon broke up too.
I saw that does not bode well. No wonder Tom Savini never wanted to direct again. If he had to wrestle with the Cannon Films guy, everyone go watch. If you don't know, go see the Electric Boogaloo, the story of Cannon Films, just to get a beat on that guy. Oh my god, yeah. Well, anyway, Malcolm Golan, woof.
But we also need to highlight the 1999 30th anniversary edition. God. And
Is this when they started adding, like, people started doing their own version? Like, just like reissues, but like.
So, not only is that the wrong year to make a 30th anniversary edition.
It says, quote unquote, directed by John Russo. I don't mean to burst your bubble, but like, the way you presented even in the notes is funny. Yeah.
I'm sorry. It's not good. So, yeah, John Russo took the original movie, quote unquote, directed a new version by shooting new footage in black and white and cutting it into the original, cut some stuff out.
In 1999?
Yes. So his version runs 92 minutes with new footage, which means it's missing some stuff from the old movie. there's all new music.
You could cut some stuff out of that movie, but I doubt he did it the right way, but yeah.
There's all new music. Guess what? Not good music. The new scenes are bad. You can watch this stuff on YouTube. It's pretty repulsive. No one looks at it from the 60s. It's just, you know, the ending is totally different and it's awful. Mm-hmm. I really do not bother with this one. Please don't. I would say.
Yeah, I'm watching it now and there's like more stuff setting up the zombie at the.
Yeah, it's bad. It's very bad.
Yeah.
The sad thing, it's not the worst thing to have Night of the Living Dead's name on it, but it's really up there.
Which speaks to how bad everything that's come in the wake of Night of the Living Dead in terms of like cashing in on that direct property. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know much about this. All I know is they put out a terrible animated version like a year ago. Ooh, and that
looks terrible. There's the
it's all flash animated and like
there's Children of the Living Dead in 2001 that's produced by John Russo, which is bad. There's Night of the Living Dead 3D with Sid Haig, which is just horrible.
I don't know much about Sid Haig, but yeah, that sounds like it could either be really good or really bad.
It's really bad. And there are two different animated ones that are bad. There's a remake set in Wales that came out in 2012.
What? Why is it Night of the Living Dead? Why not?
And then in 2021, they announced Night of the Living Dead 2.
Your highlight, yeah.
Yeah, with the
cast of Dan?
Yeah, the cast of Day of the Dead.
The original Day of the Dead?
Laurie Cardelli. Is Laurie Cardelli supposed to be in this?
Laurie Cardelli. Okay, yeah.
There's a trailer that has this one picture.
What?
And it's, as far as I can tell, it's never been made. This was 2 years ago. Nothing new.
Oh, so all those actors are going to be like 70 years old. Who wants to?
I don't.
Oh, no.
I don't know anything about it.
They probably all broke their hips at the same time signing the contract to be in the movie, and that canceled the movie.
a lot of capitalizing off the name.
And yeah, your notes here are just lengthy and just
sorry.
I'm not complaining. It's just like a field of carnage. It's the Gettysburg of what they did to the Night of the Living Dead. So who owns the rights to the Night of the Living
Dead
now?
It's public domain.
It's still public domain.
Okay, yeah. It's not like anyone attempted to like reclaim it somehow. Okay.
And this is not a new problem. Like the Fulci film Zombie was released.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, okay.
Was released in Italy as Zombie 2 because Dawn of the Dead in Italy is called Zombie. And so Fulci's like, I'm going to make a sequel. And
is that the one with the shark fighting
yes,
the zombie?
Yes,
I mean, yeah, okay, yeah. My housemates and I, we went around into that once, and that's the big thing we came away with it from, yeah.
It's a fun movie, but it's not a sequel to Dawn of the Dead.
But it's not, yeah, it has nothing to do. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Oof-a-doo.
Yeah, yeah. Also, we mentioned both by name earlier, but I want to highlight them again just because they're both really good movies that sort of expand on the Night of the Living Dead formula. As we mentioned, 1985, Return of the Living Dead takes place in a universe where there was that movie, but it also really happened, so zombies exist, yeah. Except in this movie, in this version, the zombies come back, and they're basically indestructible. So
the best zombies ever. They're fast and indestructible.
Yeah, it's a really wild watch.
It's a comedy movie as much as a horror. It may be my all-time favorite horror movie.
Now, people say it's a
zombie movie.
People say it's a comedy, but like the existential dread that film gives me way outweighs... Because
the end of
like,
that movie is also, what the hell was that, Krusty Doc gif?
Yeah, the scene where they interview, they ask a zombie, why do you eat people? And it's like, because it stops the pain of being dead. Like, oh, that's a good existential crisis. Thank you, Phil.
Well, and that's the movie that introduced the idea that that zombies eat brains. Yeah, and that's the brains. Justification for why they eat brains.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you've ever seen a movie where someone groans brains, it's from that. It's not from Night of the Living Dead. The zombies in Night and Dawn... don't really talk at all, and in Day he says one word, I think, maybe, but
something like that, yeah.
And well, speaking of Romero too, this is he kind of got his teeth kicked in because he was unfortunate enough to release Day of the Dead, his third zombie movie, right around the same time Return of the Living Dead came out, and Return of the Living Dead kind of kicked the shit out of it at the box office.
Well, because and Day they had to release Day unrated, which probably hurt it.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
It's
and that's
so
extra.
Violent. It's so
also Day
violent.
Of the Dead is also kind of a little bit of a chore. It's not bad, but if you're expecting like a Dawn of the Dead, you're not going to get that because it is just miserable. It is just sad and just like.
I mean, my favorite is Dawn, and like Dawn's the one I can watch, and it does not give me anxiety.
Dawn is that's the popcorn favorite of everybody because that's just so stupid and fun and great.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Yeah. I feel kind of bad because Day of the Dead was Romero's personal favorite. And I can kind of see why, because it deals even more with, like, social issues and how, like, a little miniature society falls apart. But it's also just not that fun because it really is just some military asshole just screaming at everybody else for 2 hours before he gets his guts ripped out.
I do like Land of the Dead.
I'll have to see.
I had a good time with that one.
I saw it once and never went revisited.
And I even, like, Diary's not great, but it's a very good commentary on social media. And also
from like an 80-year-old man
has probably the darkest ending of any of the movies.
Oh, really?
Oh boy.
Okay. Yeah, it's
well,
brutal.
I'm assuming if they were doing a Blair Witch thing, if they take after Blair Witch, which, you know, that had to
no,
it, too,
it's its own thing.
It's its own thing. Okay.
It's
good.
A unique film. It's not great, but it's different.
Okay.
And Survival is supposed to be terrible. I have not seen that. So.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, one thing we certainly highlight is as probably the lone great feeling, you know, happy ending is 2005 Shaun of the Dead, which is a loving tribute to the Romero films, officially known as a rom-zom-com, a romantic zombie comedy, but it still has, you know, has graphic violence, it has intense moments, it is not, you know, it's not all lighthearted, but certainly it, at the end of the movie, I think you feel like $1 million, so I cannot recommend that movie enough. It is fantastic. It definitely gave Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright a huge kickstart in their careers. And of course, Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright would both appear in Land of the Dead as zombies as a sort of as a tribute because Romero loved it. Romero loved that movie, so he gave them zombie cameo.
That has my favorite joke in that whole movie is they named Simon Pegg's mom Barbara. And there's a scene where they're going to go pick her up because they don't want her to get eaten by the zombies that are, you know, attacking
London.
We're
coming to get you, Barbara.
Yeah, Nick Frost yells into the phone, we're coming to get you, Barbara. But they don't even do, like, the Karloff voice. It's just, but it's still just, like, the fact that they just yell it. It's just, that movie's, my top three zombie movies, it's got to be the holy trinity of Dawn of the Dead, Return of the Living Dead, and Shaun of the Dead.
My favorite joke in that movie is, it's not hip-hop, it's electro. But that's just...
White lights.
Yeah, that too. Anyway, sorry.
I haven't even seen that movie in 5 years, but I still. And it's not like I've seen it a million times, but it's that memorable. But just, yeah, anyway.
Video games?
All right. Yes. In interest of our long-term listeners, we should probably talk about some video games because this is technically a video game podcast. And, you know, right up front, there is no official Night of the Living Dead video game. We'll put that out there. There is no official Night of the Living Dead.
That's a shocker. They just came out with a Blair Witch game of all.
However.
They came out with a Groundhog's Day game.
However, video games love zombies, and almost every video game zombie.
Oh, I know where you're going with this. Okay.
Is
yeah.
a Romero zombie. I mean, let's be honest. Almost all video games are using a Romero type zombie in their video game. Like, so its influence is unimpeachable here. You cannot ignore what Night of the Living Dead means to zombie games as a whole, and there are just so many zombie games. But if you want to get specific, we can mention the fact that a lot of Resident Evil is about trapping players in a closed space with zombies, and those zombies love to stick their arm in, you know, boarded up windows and try to grab the hero. That happens a lot. You highlight the fact that in the remake, the 2002 remake, you know, they introduced a new mechanic where you have to burn the zombies to make sure they don't get up. That is absolutely a key factor here in Night of the Living Dead. And also, I think this is a deep cut. Just maybe it's, you know, I'm crazy here, but Resident Evil 2, the opening of that movie, they've got a gas station, you know, crisis.
Yeah.
And you've got a runaway truck that crashes into town and causes an explosion. I feel like that's heavily borrowing from the story that Ben tells in this movie about the diner.
That's a really good point, actually.
Would not be
somebody
surprised.
Somebody was paying attention to that movie in ways that not a lot of people actually do. Yeah.
That's the original and the remake, by the way. They both have their runaway
truck. I still love the idea that they thought, like, well, because I think they've come out since then and said, okay, yeah, Resident Evil is supposed to take place in, like, somewhere in Pennsylvania. I still love the idea that they thought Raccoon City was a good name for, like, a city in Pennsylvania of all places, but yeah.
Yeah, I think I used to joke that for a good few years, every video game was either a remake of Night of the Living Dead, Aliens, or Saving Private Ryan. or some combination of thereof.
I kind of wonder if it's the fact that, like, no one owns the copyright to the Night of the Living Dead would make it hard, because say you made a Night of the Living Dead video game and it took off, anyone else could maybe swing in and do a sequel because you don't own the specifically needs, like, the controlling the IP for that as a video game might be more difficult than it's worth. I would imagine that's the only reason why there aren't, like, 50 million, like, even just terrible Night of the Living Dead games on Steam or something like that.
Yeah, that's not probably a safe bet there. I do know that when I moved to Pittsburgh in the early 2000s, there were some people at CMU who, for a class project, made a Night of the Living Dead game.
Oh, wow.
And that never got released, obviously. But I think they even were able to get some of that people in the movie to do voices.
Okay. And it's funny you mentioned CMU, because that's Romero. He was born in New York City and only wound up in Pittsburgh because he went to, you know, he studied at CMU filmmaking. But yeah.
CMU being Carnegie Mellon University, just for the record.
Exactamundo. Yeah.
Well, we know that Capcom and Romero did try to work together a couple times.
Unfortunately, it didn't work out.
He wrote an early script, I think, for a live-action version of Resident Evil, which unfortunately ended up not getting produced, probably because his version was A, more violent, and B, kind of dark. I want to shout out, there's a fan out there, October Keegan, who is adapting the Romero script into a comic.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah,
which,
okay.
Is slowly being released online. I just want to shout that out. It's an interesting take on Resident Evil. It's obviously a different version.
So the script is out there at least then.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, okay. You know, he's not going to make it. He's passed, unfortunately.
I love the idea that, like, he wouldn't have a script, so he's just kind of like, what? He's just taking screenshots from Night of the Living Dead and just adding, like, Resident Evil HUD elements to it, you know.
But George Romero did make a live-action commercial for Resident Evil 2.
What?
Which I think aired only in Japan.
Yeah.
And the wild thing about that is Brad Renfro, the late Brad Renfro, appears in the commercial as Leon Kennedy.
Oh, wow. So, wait, so is this what he was doing instead of making a new zombie movie? I wonder if actually just the money he got from Capcom for all this, I wonder if he didn't have to make a movie there. Maybe that's why he skipped a decade, because he was too busy getting jerked around by Capcom.
It could be. Huh. You know, if you're locked into development hell for long enough, maybe you don't want to make zombie movies for a while.
I'm actually going to have to Google Brad Renfro to see exactly who that was.
And you know, Romero made a lot of movies, but a lot of them weren't hits. So, like, that probably hurt his, like, I know, because, like, around the 2000s, he had a really hard time making movies. Because, like, you know, Monkey Shines and Dark Half, not huge,
that's as a kid, again, reading Fangoria and Gorezone and stuff like that, there was always interviews with George Romero, and he's always talking about what his next movie is, and it never turns out well. And yeah. Like, yeah.
And of course, we have to mention Dead Rising, because Dead Rising is about a bunch of human survivors during a zombie apocalypse trapped inside a shopping mall, which, spoilers, is basically Dawn of the Dead.
And seriously, yeah.
It is so much Dawn of the Dead that they actually had to put a disclaimer on the box at one point to indicate that George Romero was not involved, because people apparently were bringing up copies of the game and having Romero sign them, and he was like, I didn't make this. What are you talking about?
What the hell is this? Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
well, especially when he saw it was Capcom, he must have been like, oh, those, they wouldn't make my movie, but they're going to make my movie into a game? Yeah, yeah.
I know they said it wasn't actionable, and again, I'm not full of frivolous copyright lawsuits, but come on.
Yeah, that's...
Like, give the man some bucks for that.
Especially that's, because they worked with him, like, and that was, like, right after, like, yeah.
I think Capcom really caused, like, the second wave of zombie pop culture.
Really, they did.
With Resident Evil. And this may be...
I mean, Shaun of the Dead started off there's an episode of Spaced where he's playing... Simon Pegg is playing Resident Evil. And there's a whole Resident Evil-themed episode of Spaced.
Absolutely.
And that's what essentially turned into Shaun of the Dead.
And you know, I might have a controversial opinion here. But for me, Night of the Living Dead, one of the greatest movies ever made. But it's going to sound strange. Hear me out. It's kind of a lot like Van Halen in that it's great. But most of the stuff it influenced is dog shit.
Yeah. That's just most zombie stuff in general. Like, if you see anything zombie-related, it's almost 99% sure to be bullshit.
Especially since, like, the year 2000. Just, like, countless straight-to-video zombie movie, just complete garbage.
What do you think of the Dawn of the Dead remake?
I like it. It's not a very good horror movie, but it's fun.
I thought it was okay, but I wasn't, like, I've never seen it since I saw it in theaters. Okay, yeah.
I like Sarah Polley a lot. And
I forgot about that. Sally Salt is in that movie,
and I and Ving Rhames, and it's a well made film.
Cast. Yeah,
has a fantastic opening.
I mean, that's what Spaces. That's Zack Snyder, right?
Yeah,
and that's
Zack
his whole
Snyder.
Thing is like that's always the best part of each one of his movies.
It is.
Yeah.
It is the best remake of any of the Dead films, because like there are allegedly Day of the Dead remakes that have nothing to do with Day of the Dead.
They just take the name and just, yeah.
Those Night of the Living Dead ones we talked about earlier.
That's kind of the weird thing, because you think somebody by now would have done like a Planet of the Apes thing where they go back and remake the movies. Kind of like what George Romero was talking about was the inspiration for Night of the Living Dead anyway, where you go back and you tell the story of how this all happened and you build out from there. Kind of like what they did with the Planet of the Apes remakes, where they went like, okay, how does the world of the Planet of the Apes happen? Which is something that the original Planet of the Apes movies eventually covered, but like when they just started remaking not the Tim Burton movies, but the good ones later on, they kind of asked that same question. I'm kind of surprised. I mean, again, maybe just be a rights issue, but I'm kind of surprised no one has sat down and said, okay, let's do some remakes of at least the first three Romero zombie movies, and let's do it right, where there's like continuity between the films, they're well made. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, a lot of zombie fiction doesn't like to focus on the why, and that's another thing that I think is kind of lazy. Like, I get why you don't do it, especially the way Romero didn't do it, because it technically doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But
at least he had a bigger agenda. It's not like he didn't do it just because he didn't care, but yeah.
Yeah, but like, when you see something like, I'm just looking at a list of zombie films, like, I don't know, Plaguers, or like countless zombie films, they just have no reason for the zombies because they don't care. They just want to make a zombie movie so they can make some money.
The thing that made it so, I don't want to say it was easy to make Night of the Living Dead, but the thing that made it so affordable to make Night of the Living Dead is what makes it so affordable for anyone to make their own zombie movie, because all you need is some friends willing to like eat some raw chicken breasts and some fake blood, and technically you can make a zombie movie, and that's kind of like, that's also a big part of the legacy of Night of the Living Dead.
Unfortunately,
for better or for worse.
Yes, and crap like Flight of the Living Dead.
God, yeah.
Yeah, I would say here in Japan especially, there are so many movies that are just noun of the dead. And a lot of them are cheap to produce. A lot of them have terrible reputations. Some of them turn out well. I mean, the international title of Don't Stop the Camera, Camera Tomorrow Na, was called One Cut of the Dead, which is an excellent movie.
That movie is incredible.
Oh, I've heard of that, but I've never actually... Oh, wait, no. Is that the thing about the camera crew?
Yeah.
Oh, I started that and I fell asleep because I started at like 1 o'clock in the morning. I need to finish that. It was last Halloween. Okay, yeah.
That movie made me cry.
Okay. Really?
The movie is fantastic. The movie is absolutely fantastic.
I'm writing notes about all these recommendations right now. Okay.
Hard recommend. But for that movie, you know, for one of those, you've got like Sushi of the Dead, Toilet of the Dead, Jesus. Like all the, like anything that could be made has been made, you know, and a lot of it is just cheap garbage.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're kind of in a zombie movie lull right now, aren't we?
Thank God.
Yeah. It seems like everything's gone like, what, the Possessioning or whatever the hell, the, like all the like the possession movies, haunted doll movies. I mean, you've got the A24 quote unquote elevated horror stuff, but then you've got like all the like the horror movies with the trailers. Not to have this turn into old man yells at Cloud Corner, but just like, yeah, it's all just like, well, a big shock scare as a girl, 12-year-old girl, like walks backwards on her hands and knees at the camera, and that's like. Yeah, whatever it is, it's not zombies. So I guess possession films are the kind of the flavor of the day right now when it comes to the cheap schlock bullshit.
Well, one thing we know for sure, that whatever their current status, we know zombies are here to stay. Zombies are going to outlive us all.
They'll come back. That's the best thing about zombies, that they come back.
They always come back. They'll be making zombie movies in 2168, you know what I mean? So,
God. And you know what? I'm kind of curious to see. I know you're trying to wrap it up. You obviously, and I couldn't. But just one last thing, just with like, I'm very curious to see what the next phase of when zombies do come back and after the pandemic and everything like that. Because now you have a whole kind of new anxieties you can tap into that are just simmering out there waiting for a new George Romero. Just like the racism stuff back in the 1968. There's some new flesh to be eaten if you want to make a good zombie movie these days. And I'll be curious to see how that starts happening in the next decade or two.
I'm guessing someone's already working on Woke of the Dead. Let's be honest.
Oh no, you're absolutely... If that doesn't come out before the next presidential election, we could almost make a monetary bet that's going
to
happen.
They
would just call it Woke of the Dead because it doesn't make any sense. Oh, Woke of the Dead. What are their pronouns?
Yeah. The pronouns are okay.
I think we just wrote the movie.
Now if anyone doesn't make that movie, we could sue because we could say this podcast is essentially us mailing us a good idea to us in the mail. That's a poor man's copyright. That's what this podcast is right now.
Anyway, we've successfully podcasted about Night of the Living Dead longer than Night of the Living Dead. We're coming up on 2 hours here.
Okay,
so.
Yeah.
Let's wrap this up. You know, the sun's coming up. The posse's going to shoot us in the head soon. So why don't we go around the table? Bill, where can the internet find you?
Oh, God, I didn't even think about this part. I'm just... My name, Bill Mudron, Mudron. Just, like, Google me. I'm on Twitter. Oh, I guess Twitter's dying. By the time this comes out, Twitter may be just not a thing anymore. I have a website. I have a big cartel web shop. I'm a freelance artist, so if you need, like, video game map prints and stuff, go check out my... Just Google my name and check out my store and my website and stuff like that. So, absolutely. Yeah.
Fabulous artwork. Always good. Always good to have a Bill Mudger drawing on something.
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of work with Jeremy Parrish at Limited Run Games right now, doing some cover art and things for those guys right now. So, yeah.
What I've seen, I love. What I've seen, I love.
Thank you very much. It's very appreciated.
How about you, James?
Well, I have a podcast, Cinema Oblivia, where I talk about weird old movies. Diamond, you've been there, and some people from, you know, Retronauts and other gaming podcasts have been there too, like Alex Navarro. So if you like weird old movies, check that out. And you can find me.
Oh, that's cool.
You can find me on pretty much every social media service as Lost Turntable. We are recording this in July, the same week that Twitter introduced the rate limit fiasco. So who knows what's going to be happening. But I am on Twitter, Blue Sky, co-host, I don't know, whatever, everything. Lost Turntable. That's me.
Again, thinking about simple things that you don't realize how can impact in your life until it suddenly falls apart.
Yes.
I mean, Twitter, that's another... You can make a zombie movie about the death of, like, an online zombie movie about the death of social structures and
hashtag zombie. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have to shout out Cinema Olivia. I've been a guest on the podcast multiple times. We've talked about some really fun movies, including we did one that was not a zombie movie, but we did that monster. Was that Monster Express? Horror Express.
Horror Express. Yes.
Right. With Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing.
Did you do stuff with me? Was that you?
We talked about Q, but we also talked about Larry Cohen in general.
Q the Winged Serpent. Yeah. Okay,
yeah. I did stuff with some. I didn't do stuff. But yeah. Q.
Always want more.
Kind of a zombie film stuff. A zombie ice cream.
Yeah, actually, yeah. I mean, it kind of turns people into like acolytes of the stuff.
Yeah.
And they even take down poor Chocolate Chip Charlie. Actually, the death of Chocolate Chip Charlie in the stuff is one of the, if you want to talk, one of the few things that got me as a kid. Anyway, but yeah.
Anyway, moving on.
Spoilers for the stuff.
They're not expecting to bring up the stuff on Retronauts, but here we are. Anyway.
Yeah, exactly. What podcast has this turned into when we're talking about the death of Chocolate Chip Charlie on Retronauts?
But what is Retronauts if not a podcast that brings things back from the grave? Hey, how's that for a segue? So if you like this kind of stuff, by all means, of course you can listen to us for free. Thank you very much for listening to Retronauts. But if you go to patreon.com/retronauts, you can support us. For $3 a month, you get episodes 1 week early, and they're at a higher quality. But for $5 a month, which is just $2 more than $3, it's fact, you get exclusive episodes every month. You get exclusive stuff from me every week. I write columns. I read them to you as a podcast. We also have a community podcast where we talk about what's going on in the world of retro video games. We also have a Discord where we hang out and talk about games, movies, whatever you want to do. We've got that too. So by all means, if you listen for free, we thank you very much. But if you go to Patreon, we really appreciate it. As for me personally, you can find me around the internet as Fight Club, F-E-I-T, that's my last name, C-L-U-B. That is a blunt object with which you can cave in the head of a zombie. Last words, I guess everyone, let's start moaning. Chicken.
Chicken breast.
Good night.